tonight on Arena. Laura McGann on her documentary on the extreme sport of free diving, and Trish McAdam on her poetic film, Songs of Blood and Destiny. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The sport of free diving is one of the most dangerous of all extreme sports. Divers compete to descend to extraordinary depths on just one breath of air, often putting their lives at risk in feats of adventure bordering on the obsessive. A new documentary, The Deepest Breath, examines the sport through the story of world champion Alessia Zucchini and her Irish coach, Stephen Keenan. But this is more than a sporting documentary. It's a story of love, devotion, loyalty, obsession, and indeed tragedy. The Deepest Breath comes to Netflix next week following limited screenings in Ireland from this Friday, July the 14th. And I'm delighted to be joined on Arena this evening by the film's director, Laura McGann, an avid sea swimmer herself, but not to quite the obsessive level of her subjects in this documentary. Did your own interest in sea swimming pay into your interest in this act of free diving, Laura?
Oh, it certainly did, Sean. Thanks a million for having me on. Yeah, absolutely. Look, I've been an avid snorkeler since I was a kid. But that's about as far as it went. And we'd swim kind of couple of times a week down in Greystones, and have been doing it for about 6 or 7 years. So I get a lot from the sea, really. Like, you know, we've moved out there to be near the sea. And yeah, I'm a big fan of the water, being out on the water, whether it's a kayak or a paddleboard or whatever. So the idea of people who get to travel the world free diving in the most beautiful locations on the planet was just really inspiring for me.
And it is an extraordinary act. This, you take a breath and you go down, no breathing apparatus of any kind whatsoever with you. You hold your breath, you go down as far as you possibly can, and then you come back up, which at one level sounds like the most boring activity in the world. What do you think the attraction of it is, Laura?
Well, you know, it's something that people have been doing for thousands of years. You know, it's how people fish for different shellfish, you know, all over the world for an awful long time. I suppose it's what's new about it is that it's now also a competitive sport where people are measuring how far down they can go, and that there's really a whole industry around it now. But one of the reasons why freedivers they've told me why they do it is that, you know, you put your head in the water and you go down into this beautiful blue, which you can see for, you know, sometimes up to 30 meters, and it just calls you, and all the shit from daily life just kind of disappears.
Yeah.
And it's quiet. And that just to me sounded really beautiful. It's real, like, you know, people talk about it as an extreme sport and this and that, but actually it's like a deeply meditative experience.
Yeah.
You know, your heart rate lowers to that of a Tibetan monk, and it's a very, it's not an adrenaline sport. You know, you can't have adrenaline. You're trying to not have the urge to breathe, so everything has to go super quiet. But also you have to kick down, you know, if you drop your goggles to the bottom of the pool or something, Sean, like you have to, it's quite hard to get down. You really have to kick to get down, whereas once you get to about 30 meters under the sea, the pressure of the water above your head pushes you down, so you don't have to kick anymore. You can just relax your arms and legs, and it's almost like flying, and the pressure above you pushes you down to as far as you want to go. And you have to completely relax, but you have to keep a little bit of your mind kind of on the alert, because you do have to remember to turn around and come back up. And of course, that's where the real work starts, because all that pressure that pushed you down, now you have to work against. It's like swimming against a current, and you have to work against all that pressure to get back up. Oh.
Let's have a listen to, as I said, the two stars of the documentary in some ways are Alessia Zucchini, an Italian free diver, and her Irish coach, Stephen Keenan. Let's have a listen to Alessia in a TV interview talking about what free diving is for her.
Can you describe the feeling of diving at those kind of depths? Talk about the feeling on the body of the pressure.
The deeper I'm diving, the pressure compresses the air in my lungs till my lungs are the size of my fist. After 30 meters, the pressure pushes me down. It's called the free fall, and this is for me the best part. It feels like you are flying. The silence, it's unique. It's like being in the last quiet place on the earth.
That is Alessia Zucchini there describing the act of free diving and what it means to her. She's a world champion free diver and she's one of the subjects of The Deepest Breath, a documentary by Laura McGann. Laura speaking with me on the programme this evening. Even as she describes it in that television interview there, we get a real sense of what you were talking about beforehand, Laura, this almost meditative state. And at another point, I remember Stephen Keenan, who is her coach late into the film, he's sitting doing yoga and you think, of course he has to do yoga because they need to have that wonderfully relaxed state. Talk to me a little bit about Stephen and where he fits into the story of Alessia's attempts to break world records.
Yeah, so I suppose Stephen was an explorer. He left Dublin to see the world and he travelled around Australia, around Asia, around America, north and south, and then he went to Africa and he literally like traveled to every country in Africa on his own, on a shoestring, really kind of just seeing how he got on. And he went, you know, up to through the Congo, he went up into volcanoes, and he went down into the sea, and he really like he met with people that you know, and we're deep into the forests and jungles in the Congo, and just kind of stayed with communities and really had travels with a great deal of kind of seriousness,
yeah.
You know. And he eventually ended up in Dahab, where he wanted to update his PADI scuba diving license, and he did that there, and he's decided to stay. Dahab is a place where there is, of course, this incredible dive site called the Blue Hole. And so Stephen would have started to scuba there. And then that's when he learned, he got a job as a scuba diving instructor. And that's when he also came across free diving.
And eventually he became, due to a heroic act on his part, basically saving somebody in this incredibly difficult situation who was in real trouble, and he rescued them out of it, putting his own life at risk. He became what's referred to as a member of the safety team. And these are the divers that go down under the water alongside the free diver to help them back up to the top, because that last little, the last 10, 20, 30 metres on the way back up, that's where all the difficulties are, the major difficulties can occur.
Exactly. Stephen was he actually held the Irish record. I think it was 61 meters.
Yeah.
And he held that for a while. And he was going to different competitions as an athlete. And he kind of found that the safety teams quite often didn't really have the skills to really properly look after the athletes who were attempting kind of personal bests. And he thought something needs to be done about this. So then that's when he started to train as a safety diver himself, and he became he became world renowned within the industry as being an incredible diver that's really dedicated to his athletes. And yes, like you said there, he was doing the safety for Alexei Molchanov, who's the deepest man in the world, and he was extending his world record up to 118, I think it was, in Kalamata in Greece, and I think it was around 2011. And with any dive, there's a deep safety, and then there's a shallow safety, and then there's a surface safety. And Stephen was the deep safety, which means he goes down to 30 meters, and swims back up then with the all going well with the athlete. Whereas this day he went down to 30 meters and there was no sign of Alexei. And he waited there for a while. Usually they wouldn't have to wait at all. And eventually he saw Alexei down at around 14 meters circling the rope, which just really isn't a good sign. Mm. And he was completely disorientated and Stephen had to go down to 40 meters. And Alexei is a big guy. There was a big difference between the height of two men and yeah. he brought him back up. And it was the deepest safety rescue
ever,
you know, in yeah. the history of sport. Yeah, and it was really seen that, like, you know, Stephen risked his life to bring Alexei back up. And, yeah. you know, Alexei was forever, forever grateful.
Of
obviously.
Course, of course he was. And Alessia then, the Italian free diver with whom Stephen became involved, first of all on the safety team, then he started to train her. And there's certainly a large suggestion that they were very close to each other on an emotional level as well. That is the story that you begin to tell within this. But what I did wonder, snorkeling out around Greystones is one thing, Laura McGann, but the depths to which the camera has to go to in this, in your film, some of the cinematography, the underwater cinematography, the coming back up, watching the diver coming up alongside that rope, how much of that did you take yourself? How much of it was already existed in previous footage?
Right, so just to be clear, I didn't go down with that camera to anywhere near those depths.
Yeah.
The shot that you might be talking about is the opening shot in the film. And that's the deepest shot that we actually have. And that was shot by an underwater drone in 2017. So that the camera follows the diver down and follows them back up again. But a lot of the footage in the film is actually shot by free divers themselves. Some of it's shot yeah. by scuba divers, but the majority of it is shot by, you know, videographers who are on breath hold, who are free divers, and that's because in order to move with the athlete, you need to be on. You can't with scuba diving. You have to decompress to come back up, so you have to do it slowly. Whereas a free diver needs to be able to come up at speed, go down at speed, and really move around and not be you know, laden down by massive tanks on your back. So there's a kind of fluidity to the way that they shoot, which is, you know, when I was looking at this footage for the first time, it was really like something I'd never seen before. You know, I love Blue Planet. I love all those underwater programs about the animals, but this was different. It was shooting the ocean in a way that I'd never seen done before. And so that we also filmed out, we filmed in Dahab, we filmed in the Bahamas, but we also filmed in Mexico with a group of free diving cinematographers. And, you know, it was like having a pod of dolphins in the crew. Like, it was really unbelievable. They'd go down and get the shot and come back and show me. And I'd be just on the surface holding on to this little blue noodle that they gave me. And they'd show me the shot and, like, I'd say, that's really great, guys.
Yeah.
Would you mind just going down there again and getting at it? And they'd say, yeah, no problem. And they'd all head off, all six of them.
Do it again. Yeah.
Head off to do it again. It was kind of magical. You know, yeah, really, out of the world.
Well, the visual feast that we get, a result, is magical as well. But there is, and I want to be careful about how I touch, how the film finishes up. But we're following Alessia and Stephen for the entire film, most of it in archive footage. We have a feeling all along, or certainly I had a feeling all along, something is going to go wrong here. It is an incredibly dangerous sport. I mean, did you ever, at any point, I did find myself at sometimes watching it going, stop, please don't go down, please don't try this, it's way too dangerous. Did you find yourself kind of wondering about even the ethics, I suppose, of capturing this stuff or using this material as entertainment?
I suppose with freediving, it's very much, they mitigate the risk as much as possible. They're all adults, you know, they're all adults who know the risks. You know, this is a sport that's streamed, all the competitions are streamed live, you know, for anyone who wants to watch them. And they're trying to get the recognition, you know, for the sport so that it is more widely available for people to enjoy. Freedivers want to come home in the evening and have their dinner. You know, nobody is out there to hurt themselves. And I suppose they take really seriously the safety. You know, they over the years, the safety protocols have evolved to be really like quite a major setup. Like I was saying, there's like three safeties in the water at the very least. There's more on the surface, there's more on the platform, there's medics on the platform, there's medics on the beach. You know, they take the safety of the sport very, very seriously. But like any sport, you know, football can be very dangerous. Like there is an element of risk. And most of the time it's absolutely fine. But I suppose what I felt was important about telling this story was not that, you know, it ends tragically, but of a celebration of two people who had a dream to live in a different way, you know, not to do, you know, perhaps what was expected of them, and to really experience the world and go on adventures and follow their gut and find their own path. And, you know, both of them had this like beautiful curiosity and a bit of a wild streak.
Yeah.
And really the film is sets out to really celebrate that.
Well, it does that for sure, and it's a very interesting watch indeed. Laura, thanks so much for being with us this evening.
Thanks a million, Sean. Nice talking to you.
You too. That's Laura McGann there, and Laura's documentary film, The Deepest Breath, has limited release in cinemas in Ireland from July the 14th. It will be released globally on Netflix on Wednesday, July 19th. It's coming up to 20 minutes past 7 on Monday night's Arena. Now, if you thought musical rivalries were something of a modern phenomenon, Blur versus Oasis, Taylor Swift versus Katy Perry, well, let me disavow you of that notion right now. Musical rivalries go back a long time and were just as acute in the world of classical music as they were in any other genre. One of those rivalries will actually be celebrated at the upcoming Dublin Handel Fest. It takes place this Friday, July the 14th through until Sunday, July the 16th. The opening concert of the festival will be entitled Mr. Charles the Hungarian, Handel's Rival in Dublin. And it focuses on a man described as brazen and opportunistic and who attempted to capitalize on the Europe-wide fame of George Frederick Handel. If there's anybody who knows about Mr. Charles the Hungarian, and indeed Mr. George Frederick Handel, is my next guest, Peter Whelan, director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra, and indeed of the Handel Fest as well, that Dublin Handel Fest that's coming up. This Charles the Hungarian guy, Peter, I have to say, he is very colourful. And when you consider that in April of 1742, we'd had the first performance ever of Handel's Messiah in Dublin. In May of the same year, only a few weeks later, Mr. George the Hungarian has an advertisement in the Dublin Mercury at the Music Hall in Fishamble Street, tomorrow being Wednesday the 12th of May 1742, will be performed a grand concert of music by Mr. Charles the Hungarian, master of the French horn, with his second, accompanied by all the best hands in this city. If ever there was, you know, that Isle Messiah thing that you heard a couple of weeks ago, forget about that. The real concert's taking place now. Was he really was out for Handel's business, wasn't he?
Well, he had a cheek, definitely, just coming along. He was amazing. He's using the same musicians as Handel. He maybe even played for Handel now and again. And the same place that Handel had performed Messiah, as you say, a few weeks before. And we have this larger-than-life guy. We don't really know where he's from. He's calling himself Mr. Charles the Hungarian. Maybe he just had a big fancy moustache and he was styling himself as a kind of an eccentric. But his programme, we have it like complete from a newspaper at the time, and it's just full of amazing music. So we can more or less like completely recreate this concert that he gave.
Yeah, so that's what you're going to do. It's one of the things you're going to do. In fact, you've recreated the concert as an album, as a CD. You did that with the Irish Baroque Orchestra recently.
Yeah, that's right. And that's just been recently released. Some pieces are really obvious, like the water music. It's clear that was a big crowd puller back then as it is now. And then there's some other interesting pieces that he puts. He styles himself as somebody who's introducing some instruments for the first time to Ireland, including an instrument called the shalamo and the clarionet, which, of course, is the clarinet. Mm. And he could play all
of
these instruments.
And the shalamo was a precursor to the
Clarinet. It's a really beautiful sounding instrument, actually. And we have one track on the CD, this Hassa Concerto for the Shalamo. It's a very soft sounding instrument, a bit like the duduk, which is kind of a Middle Eastern instrument as well. And the clarinet then, which is a much brighter instrument, clarionet, comes from little clarino, little trumpet. And then, of course, he's an amazing horn player, and he's bringing, like, his second is always very telling. Sometimes his wife played horn with him, sometimes with one of his students. You occasionally meet, like, yeah, different people he's working with. But yeah, a larger than life, very colourful character.
Let's have a listen to a little bit of the water music. And surprise, surprise, there are quite a lot of horns to be heard here. Section there of the opening movement from Handel's Water Music, the opening allegro, and very much horn music to the fore there, Peter Whelan, as we were hearing. I guess that harks back to the fact that it was for open air performance, so you needed the big loud instruments for that.
That's right, yeah, and especially for that, you know, the first water music was performed on the Thames on boats, so you needed people to hear from either side what was going on. But horns, of course, like originally come from hunting music, so especially in Dublin, hunting was really popular. You know, if you were of the upper classes and you lived in, say, Merrion Square, Stephen's Green, within an afternoon's ride, you could be in the Dublin Mountains, you do your hunt and you come back down again. And of course, you need the horns with you to signal to each other, like, where the deer is, what direction it's going. Somebody's giving information to somebody else across the field. So anybody worth his salt in Dublin would have a pair of horn players living with them, like kind of like a very upmarket doorbell that you'd have to announce people coming into your house as well. And then they'd trot out with you into the mountains during the day. So yeah, the horn was a very popular instrument. And when Mr. Charles, our hero here, when he lived in Dublin, he used to give horn lessons to gentlemen on Dame Street as well. So it was a big part of it as well.
And not only that, what's interesting in terms of the horn players sometimes in Mr. Charles's orchestra is their ethnic origin.
That's right. Well, you know, with this discovery we're doing with the Irish Baroque Orchestra, we always find how cosmopolitan the music world and actually the world of Ireland was back then and in Dublin. As it turns out, very frequently these horn players, who are of course working with horses and working with the hunt, are ex-indentured slaves travelling from America. And the way into work in free society is working with horses for these noblemen. And working with horses meant playing the horn. And some of these became great virtuosos. So you get very often mentions with Mr. Charles. Sometimes he has a black player playing with him. And we also have portraits from the time of black horn players. So, yeah, much more cosmopolitan and diverse world than you'd imagine from back then.
And the other aspect, that you mentioned there is the various instruments. The multi-instrumentalist was a big thing at the time. So he wasn't just playing the horn, Mr. Charles. Could he play every single woodwind instrument, or did he just say he could?
I think that was part of his shtick. He was showing off that to say he could do that. He was introducing these instruments. So he said the shalamo, the clarinet, and the oboe d'amour, he said, never heard in this kingdom before. So who knows how good he was at any of these. And, you know, we can see exactly how he laid out the concert. Lots of music, actually more than you could fit in a CD. And always the best pieces are at the beginning, because I think by the end of a concert, people would be a little bit, have a few drinks taken. So it wouldn't matter quite so much if he took out his oboe d'amour right at the very end.
The Adolf Haas concerto, we're going to listen to the adagio movement of this. This possibly would be earlier on when people would be quiet and attentive, I'm guessing.
That's right. Yeah, this is near the beginning of the concert. It's such a sweet sound to this instrument.
Is this the famous shalamo that we're hearing here?
That's right, the shalamo, yeah, which is a predecessor of the clarinet, a very soft, silky sounding instrument.
An epic poem in conversation with the past and the present while always taking stock of what it really means to be human. Marina Carr's Eye Girl has been reimagined into a striking feature film by the visual artist and filmmaker Trish McAdam. film is called Songs of Blood and Destiny, and among the cast members, Eileen Walsh, Kathy Belton and Brian Gleeson. Narrative storytelling is put to the one side as figures like Joan of Arc, Antigone, Jocasta and of course Oedipus speak directly to camera and recount their experience in a stream of consciousness. All the while, striking visuals are overlaid while these iconic figures seem to ask themselves what their lives were for and whether it was all worth it. Songs of Blood and Destiny has its world premiere this Saturday at the Galway Film Fla. Delighted to be joined in studio this evening by Trish McAdam. Did you read the poem, first of all, Trish? Or how did you come across Marina's work here and decide that a visual representation of it was something you wanted to do?
Well, it was actually a coincidence with Clonmel Junction Festival, because Roger Doyle had done an opera version of iGirl, and they were going to put it on during COVID. So it's a COVID story.
Yeah, I remember talking to them at the time, the excitement of it.
Yeah, yeah. And so they asked me to do something, and so I did this visual piece, and I came across the poem. I was only doing Oedipus, but then I got the poem in my lap and I read it and I thought, this is really kind of speaking my language. It's kind of funny because it was COVID time, I was reading a lot.
Yes.
And I was reading Bergman about matter and memory. I was reading about AI and memory going down. And I was looking at 2001 Space Odyssey and I was reading about Sapiens. And I picked up this poem and I thought, this is speaking my language.
It certainly touches a lot of that material that you're speaking about there. But the thing that for me it covers, I don't know if it's fair to say most, but it's these iconic female characters, particularly from Greek mythology. I know Marina is really interested in that at the moment. Indeed, her play at the Abbey at the moment, dealing with that very topic as well, Girl on an Altar. How does she treat the big mythological characters in this poem?
Well, I feel that, you know, mostly it's the narrator is set in a contemporary writer.
Yeah, who's so this is Eileen Walsh is this narrator.
Yeah, Eileen Walsh, yeah. And she's having a crisis about her writing. Mm. And she's thinking, well, I'm just a footnote. That I think that brings her back to think, well, what women have done anything meaningful? So she goes to Joan of Arc, I think, as somebody who has fought physically and stood up for what she believed in and was burnt to death as a result. Then she goes to Antigone, the truth teller, and she dies for speaking her mind. And I think, you know, both of them are in some ways, they're played by two very young women.
Yeah, Ella Lily Highland and Holly Strutton, both of whom are about to be part of the big Amazon Prime series, which is on the way. And I mean, they are stars in the making. There's no question about that.
Yeah, but I think what Eileen is doing there is bringing a young woman's voice to the fore and putting them into a Greek character and saying, this is not new. This is not new. That history repeats itself.
Yeah.
And so she is recreating in the Greek characters in a modern way. And the way Holly and Ella do Joan of Arc and Antigone is as young women today. They're speaking as Antigone, but as now at the same time.
Let's have a listen to a section early on which features Eileen Walsh. As you say, it's the kind of the writer in crisis and wondering, what am I at and what am I doing? In some ways, that's part of what's going on here at any rate. Let's listen to the words first of all, and then we can talk about the sort of visuals that we get as we're listening to these words being spoken.
Breasts are like string theory, connected to everything. So obvious, we have to deny them. Misogyny too. Poor men. Why, the poor men. God love them. A little ode to men. That fabulous, vanished creature. Who used to turn up with the haunch of the deer. Fling it at our feet. So they could touch the unmentionables. the breasts.
That's Eileen Walsh as the narrator in the film that we're speaking about this evening, Songs of Blood and Destiny. And the film's director is with me in studio this evening, Trish McAdam. The words are so powerful in and of themselves, and it's amazing when you hear them as pure audio, you realise the power of the words themselves. And it's interesting, in some ways what you've done visually with this is almost as little as you possibly could. Trish, was that on your mind, not to overlay things? Tell us what we're looking at for the most part. How do you describe what we're looking at on the screen?
Well, you know, I honestly think that when I read Marina's work, what I feel is that she's raw. She doesn't over-polish what she's doing. She allows herself to say things and then she doesn't go, should I say that or shouldn't I? So the stream of consciousness, and I had been reading some of the stuff, obviously, she was reading. So string theory is, you know, it's really kind of interesting that she's going string theory. She's also talking about bodies. You know, she's talking about the, you know, the animalness of human beings. So we've both got this theory of the universe and strings and breasts. So I found this footage. You ask, well, how would you possibly find that footage? But if I found this footage of the interior of a body, of all the veins, so the strings are going over the veins of the body. And, you know, I think I felt I was tuning into a way Marina was thinking rather than trying to illustrate.
Yeah, it's not a literal representation.
And then Eileen does this extraordinary thing where she's talking about the people bringing back the haunch of the deer. And I don't know how could she possibly have known she was doing this, but she puts her head back and it goes so far back. For some reason, it suddenly looks like a deer. It's extraordinary.
And the aspect, what we're looking at for the most part, there are other images that come in and out, but as the actors are speaking, it's more or less a good 75 to 80% of the time, it's their face, just their head, sometimes with white, a kind of primitive type of makeup that's on it, like not clown makeup is the wrong word, but a kind of a white mask type of makeup that they're often wearing.
I think mask is a very good word. And actually, I think the process of how we made this is really interesting because we made it in like 7 days. So there's six characters. Eileen had 2 days because she's a lot of words.
Yeah, she kind of tops and tails it. Yeah.
1 day. There was no rehearsals. So the actors came in having read, you know, their piece at home, so they were, you know, they were prepared. But they came in and we shot in the morning, just reading from the page. And they would, by lunchtime, be starting to get off the page. But the thing I did with them was I said to them, the sound guy, I got him to do, you know, a takes of the best takes. And I asked them to sit in the studio with the camera on their own and listen to themselves while I recorded their faces thinking about it.
Wow.
And after lunch, I think this was very empowering for them because they could hear how far we'd got and how far we needed to go. And after lunch, we put the mask on. And when you put the white mask on the face and they've listened to themselves, suddenly it turns up a level.
Yeah.
Goes up a pitch.
And you see, we see that masked face and sometimes then projected onto the face, we have other images on top of the mask because it's like a white screen in some ways. Yeah. It allows other images to be visible. Sometimes it's wafting grass. Sometimes it's something more specific than that.
Yeah.
But those images are on the faces themselves.
It's trial and error though. You know, what you end up putting on. It sort of works instinctively. So it's and that's how I feel I was tapping into what Marina was doing. Is it's instinctive words and then these are instinctive visuals that seem to work, but they're not logical.
Let's have a listen to a clip that features Kathy Belton as Jocasta. Jocasta being the woman who married Oedipus, who is, of course, her son. So he's both her son and her husband, and she has children with him, and the Greek tragedy that follows on there. So this is, she's speaking about her first husband, who was pretty annoyed at her. So he takes off the young Oedipus off to an island. When he comes back, she doesn't realise that. But that's the bedraggled boy that she's referring to within this clip. Kathy Belton as Jocasta from Songs of Blood and Destiny.
First thing I said to him,
bedraggled boy of 19. Said, best I've ever had.
And there we go, that's Kathy Belton as Jocasta in Songs of Blood and Destiny, the film's director Trish McCallum with me in the studio this evening. And I was saying as we were listening to that, Trish, how Kathy Belton just lets the language just come through her and have its effect on her. It's very, very powerful when you watch it and listen to it.
Yeah, there's two things going on there. The language, I think, is all of them. What I was saying to them is that Marina talks about, you know, when she's writing, it seems to come from the gods. She's not really writing it herself. And I was saying, you have to imagine you're Marina and that the words are coming one at a time. So you don't know what the next one's going to be. So you have to think between the words. And that's when it really starts to become quite electric, because the words kind of merge with each other.
Yeah.
But I think the other thing that's there is there's two heads. There's the head of Kathy Belton and Brian Gleeson.
Brian Gleeson is the Oedipus character.
Yeah, and because they're incestuous, they're mother and son and husband and wife, they're merged together.
Yeah.
And it. The two things together.
They do say a lot. And I want to name all the cast. In fact, Brian Quinn, who plays a character called Neanderthal, Brian Gleeson as Oedipus, Kathy Belton as Jocasta, the two younger actors, Ella Lilly, Highland as John Dark, and Antigone, played by Holly Sturton, the narrator, Eileen Walsh, and Holly Sturton and Ellie Lilly Highland. 15 Love is the series that they're going to be in, but it's just a really interesting visual in Irel Feast, and thanks so much. You must be looking forward to seeing it on the big screen in Galway.
I am indeed, Trish. Yeah.
Yes, I would like to see it on the big screen as well.
Hopefully it will be in more than Galway. I think this is the beginning of its journey.
Well, best of luck with it all. Songs of Blood and Destiny has its world premiere at the Galway Film Flag this coming Saturday, July the 15th at 4:30. That's at the Palace Cinema. And there will be a post-screen discussion with Trish McAdam. You can find out full information on Galway Film Flag. A little section there from the opening movement from the Adagio movement from the Haas Concerto in F major. A whole raft of woodwind instruments certainly playing there in the Irish Baroque Orchestra. That is part of their album, Mr. Charles the Hungarian, and will be part of the performance as part of this year's Dublin Handelfest. Peter Whelan with me in studio this evening. So are you're going to replicate, as you did on the album, you're going to replicate the concert on the night. Is that the plan, Peter?
That is the plan. So thanks to the OPW, we're working in Dublin Castle, which is just amazing.
The perfect
location.
Only around the corner from the original venue.
Exactly. You couldn't be much closer. A stone's throw away, basically. So it's just a wonderful space to have to perform all of these things. But yeah, we're going to do our best to recreate the concert for a live audience in this wonderful setting that, you know, Handel would have known. And it's all part of our discovery of, you know, what else was going on in Dublin the time Handel was here.
And as I said, this is only a couple of weeks. May 1742, April 1742 being the date of the month of the first performance of Handel's Messiah. How much Handel mania, as they call it, was there in Dublin at the time? Are we talking on the same levels as Beatlemania?
Oh, I reckon so, at least. I think people are really hungry for music. And as we know, you know, Handel came to Dublin not knowing what to expect, and he was having a terrible time in London. He is a big flop over there with, you know, his operas were failing. He's losing lots of money. His health was failing. And some musicians with an Irish background, it seems, invited him over, said, you can make a killing here. You know, you'll be welcomed. People will love your work. And it was true. Like, it was so popular in Ireland that, like, before he'd a chance to get off the boat, he couldn't even unpack his instruments and his clothes. He was already been whisked around high society. And he did concert after concert. He had to do a second subscription. It was so popular as well. He was selling tickets from his house in Liffey Street himself. So he was a bit of a celebrity. You know, you queue upside the door, see if you get a glimpse of
no
the big man himself.
No Ticketmaster then, no.
Well, I know.
No, no, exactly. I think it's like part of like seeing the musician, you know, afterwards. Yeah. He gets to sign whatever as you buy the ticket.
But of course, famously, the story goes that the gentlemen at the first performance of Messiah had to take off their swords and leave them outside because they couldn't carry the swords in. The room was too packed. What about Mr. Charles the Hungarian 3 weeks later? Did he have a packed house? Did the gentlemen have to remove their swords once
again? Who knows? Well, you know, the first performance of Messiah was another first example of a one-way system in Europe because they had to make a one-way system up Fishamble Street and air conditioning because they had to remove a pane of glass. So perhaps they'd learned all of that from Handel's performance. It would have been a lovely, cool performance with good traffic control outside as well.
And give me a sense of some of the other stuff happening at the festival, because it goes on for the weekend, isn't it?
The whole weekend, we use all of the beautiful spaces in Dublin Castle. There's recitals with the youth orchestra. We have Claire Duff doing a recital. There's a walking tour. There's stuff for young people as well. Yeah, you should check it out. There's lots and lots going on.
Lots and lots going on. And the main thing being that performance of yours, of the Mr. Charles the Hungarian concert. That's on the 14th, isn't it?
That's on right, Friday on Friday night. Exactly. Yeah, that's
great. Right. Well, okay, look, lots for people to check out there. And thanks for coming in to tell us about it. That's Peter Whelan, director of the Irish Baroque Orchestra and indeed director of the Dublin Handel Fest as well. Handel Fest, the festival kicks off this Friday, July the 14th, concert by the orchestra under Peter's direction, entitled Mr. Charles the Hungarian, Handel's Rival in Dublin, takes place at 7:30 p.m. in St. Patrick's Hall in Dublin Castle. Recreation of the concert that was first staged in Smock Alley in May 1742. Full details about that and everything happening at this year's festival on dublinhandelfest.com. Charles-Édouard Jeanneret, better known as Le Corbusier, was a designer, painter, urban planner and one of the pioneers of modernist architecture. Many of his works have been named World Heritage Sites by UNESCO, and his design principles continue to influence the way we live today. His manifesto, Towards an Architecture, was published 100 years ago, and to mark its centenary, we are looking back at his career and legacy. Helping me to do so is architectural historian Emma Gillies, who's with me in studio this evening. Just a little bit on Le Corbusier, first of all, and his background, not his real name, Le Corbusier.
No, and I'm glad you said his name first, because I'm going to be murdering the French language.
Don't worry, I'll help you.
Yeah, so he's such an enigma, and the more I read about him, the more intriguing he is. So I tweeted that I was coming on here, and of course people, they have opinions about, you know, he was kind of going towards communism and fascism and, you know, lots of books about that. But the man himself, so he's born in Switzerland in 1887, the son of a watchmaker, and that was the road he was set upon. He was training himself to be a watchmaker, and I think that informed his career down the road. And then he set his sights on architecture. And so this, the start of the 20th century, he's mixing with all these avant-garde architects and different movements. Like you mentioned there, a modern movement. And he would be talking all the time with his contemporaries, like Walter Gropius would be a name we'd know, with the Bauhaus in Germany and then the Stiel in Holland. And he was a great self-publicist. So it's his name that stands out prominently when we talk about the modern movement or the international style of architecture.
Well, because he is his Vers une architecture, or Towards an Architecture, let's just call it that for ease of pronunciation. Yeah. His manifesto, as it were, which was published 100 years ago in 1923. What are the main tenets? What is he saying there that changes architecture totally, or the way that architecture was being thought about at the time?
Yeah, so the book, it was a combination of seven essays that he was kind of working on for years, and he funneled his ideas into, like I said, these five principles. So beforehand, buildings are very heavy. They're very, there were throwbacks to earlier architectural styles. They were, you know, neo-Gothic, they were neoclassical. They were anchored to the ground, but his buildings were about space and void, and supported, unsupported. So the five principles
I'm going to tweet an image, and we'll talk about each of those five tenets in relation to this image.
Yeah, possibly, so people make can it be easier. Looking at it. Yeah.
So I'm going to tweet right now at RT Arena Ronchamp, which is a little church, isn't it? the mushroom, as we've been calling it all day when we look at it. This is an extraordinary building. And the first thing we notice, I suppose, is the big, it's a church, but there's a big, it's like a spire, but in some ways it's just a big column to the left-hand side of the image. That's one of the first of the tenets, isn't it? Pilotis.
Yes, pillars. So so this building, it's a beautiful building. You have to go and see it in real life. It was built in the 50s and it's kind of when he moved away and it was kind of getting more organic in its form. So the roof, he doubled the thickness in this concrete church, and the roof actually looks like it's floating. It's beautiful. It's so light, but it's actually supported on a forest of pillars. So that's number one, the pillar, and it allowed the walls not to be these load-bearing structures and made for lighter buildings. So we're going against
which all linked in, I suppose, to engineering developments at the time, which were discovering these type of possibilities of making buildings that didn't have to have supporting walls.
Yeah.
The other aspect that I noticed, free plan was another of the big tenets. Yeah. Now, obviously, that's easy in a church. You don't have any dividing walls. You know, it's a big open space inside. But he carried that into living spaces, domestic living spaces as well.
Yeah, like, so we saw it in, he really gone into the international stage with his pavilion in the Paris exhibition in 1925. And that was an open space to show this free space. And again, in the Church of Ronchamp, it's one space inside. And he was very into the promenade, directing people around the circulation. So that's what that free space is
about.
So
it'll be designed in such a way that you kind of, when you walk in, the architecture brings you on a certain journey through the space rather than you just saying, I'll walk over here.
Exactly. And also for allowing light into space. He's very into the environment and health and people.
And the other thing is ribbon or horizontal windows were a big part of one of the big five tenets as well. As we look at this image at RTE Arena, we see those little horizontal, almost slit-like windows. They let in more light, though, ironically, don't they? Isn't that part of the reasoning behind them?
In Ronchamp, is it?
Well, the horizontal style windows rather than a big square window. Now, there are some square windows here as well.
Yeah, in Ronchamp, there are smaller windows to let in the light for coloured stained glass. But yeah, his earlier ones were these glass curtain walls, and to let in the glass and maximise the light coming in. And also those horizontal windows, it allows for you to have an uninterrupted view to the outside. So he's very much into bringing the outside in, which is, again, is very new when you're emerging out of the 19th century.
I'm going to actually tweet another image now as well, which alongside the one that we've just seen, it tells another story. It's of St. Michael's Church in Chrysla. And you see it as we look at this image at RTE Arena, it almost looks like a big white mountain, the way it
is.
The way
it echoes form. Yeah, so you're taking your influence from your surroundings, from the environment. And also when you go inside the church, you see the little windows that are in Ronchamp. So Liam McCormack, as a student, went to see this church, and it had such a huge influence on him in his career.
And the other aspect of that, because he designed this church in Chrysla, Liam McCormack.
He did, in Donegal,
And the other aspect of it here is, which again fits into the tenets, this, the free facade type of thing. So it's not heavily structured. It's really a flowing line.
Yes. And like you said, this was all made possible by the engineering at the time. And he in the book, in Towards an Architecture, he's obsessed with automobiles and airplanes and this using industrialization, but to help people and to actually become more natural and to help our way of life and community.
And this again would fit into the other of the big tenets, the terrace garden. These were roof gardens that were often in the buildings. Are there roof gardens in any of the buildings? Did Ronchamp or any of those have roof gardens, or would that be more in somewhere like the Villa Savoy?
Yeah, so the Villa Savoy in the 20s, that has the roof garden, and also in his famous kind of vertical communities like Unité d'Habitation.
Yeah, let me tweet Unité d'Habitation right now. So we'll do that again. And this is in Marseille.
The first one was in Marseille, completed in the 50s, and it was revolutionary. So his idea was everybody, no matter if you're rich or poor, living in the same space. So obviously a single occupant, you'd have a smaller one and a family, a bigger one. But the corridors were these wide streets. So it was a city in the sky. I stayed, there's a hotel on the middle floor that I stayed in. It had one of the very first supermarkets in France. It had to have directions on the wall to tell people how it's self-service, because, you know, like our grannies and our mothers, you go into the shop and the shopkeeper
serves you. Yeah.
It had a school at the top. It had a pool. It had a gymnasium. There was a running track on the top. So everything that he thought you needed in a city within this one block, and it's set within a kind of parkland, yeah, to you'd have access to greenery and space.
You mentioned that when you tweeted that you were coming in to speak about it, that a lot of people get into the politics. How problematic are his politics, Le Corbusier?
Well, like, as I mentioned, his politics are a bit dubious. I actually think he was just such a chancer that he thought, if I side with the Vichy government with the at the war, they might give me more work. He early on was on a visit to Moscow. He was talking to communist government. I think he just
he was a pragmatist.
He was a pragmatist. His vision was he wanted to design a city. He wanted the plan. So he wanted to get that high up that somebody would say, give me your plan. Now, later on, the Punjab government would give him that opportunity in 1950. But his very early plan was to level half of Paris and to slot in 18 high-rise buildings, within this green parkland, and an extreme version of Unity to help people live better.
One final and very brief answer, if you could. Where do you side on the Eileen Gray versus Le Corbusier kind of debate? Did he kind of claim an awful lot of her work, or what is your opinion on that in a short couple of sentences?
Well, it's very complicated. Eileen Gray, we all know her, she's a gay icon, a very strong independent woman. So she builds E1027. Go look it up, it's an amazing building in France, near Monaco. He became obsessed with the building. I actually think she exhibited the five principles better than him. This building became obsessed.
And maybe that's what annoyed him.
He painted these eight murals, but ironically, him desecrating the building actually saved the building, because people attributed it to him and they didn't knock it down.
As you say, it is a complex story and there's a lot more to it, but you did well in giving us a 45-second version of it. That's Emma Gillies helping us to celebrate 100 years of Le Corbusier, and that is our lot for this Monday evening. I'm Andine Passodivine, and Paula Shields researched. Michelle Gibson was the broadcast coordinator. Ruth Kennington was on sound this evening. And tonight's programme produced by Olam McGann. Talk to you tomorrow night once again, 7 o'clock here on RTE Radio 1. John Creedon will be with you after the news.